comrade we have tonight with us, another comrade imported from San Francisco, who is going to talk to us tonight about current radicalization, periods of radicalization in this country. As we know, if you've read the current ISR, it's a large article on previous radicalizations as compared to the one that is going on at present, which Comrade Novak's estimates started at about 1960. Comrade Asher here is going to talk to us about the breadth and the depth and the character of the ones that went before. Comrade here. Start.
Comrade, you'll have to forgive me if quite often in this talk that I'm about to give, I will use my own experiences. It's not that I'm boasting, not at all. I know, like all comrades in the operating in the trade union movement, that you kind of operate as you do and as we have without the party. But I know my own experiences better, and my experiences sort of reflect the general experiences of the rank and file of the that have been operating in the trade union movement. The Trotskyists, during the rise of the CIO, played no particular role, no big role. They played a role, but no big role. And why not? Because the Trotskyist movement, at the beginning of the rise of the CIO, I'm starting about 1933-34, we're still, the movement was still in the process of consolidation, splits, unifications, and so forth. And it didn't have any great depth or penetration into the trade union movement. That was a period in which we were negotiating with the CLA, the Committee for Labor Action, the Musty Group, which later became the American Workers' Party. That was a period in which we were the Communist Labor Alliance, and we were negotiating with the American Workers' Party, the Musty Group. That is in the spring of 1934. The merger with the American Workers' Party was very important for the Trotskyist movement, because the American Workers' Party was primarily trade unionists. It started as a group of militant trade unionists, rather loosely organized, and as they developed politically, they became a political party, and very shortly thereafter, we began negotiating for a merger. And that merger began and was concluded in 1934. The first collaboration with the American Workers' Party was during the Toledo strike of 1934, in which we were very active, and some of our leading comrades in labor became leaders of the Socialist Workers' Party, such as Art Price, Ted Sealander, Sam Pollock, were very active in that. We were active in the Toledo auto strike. We were active in Minneapolis, as all of you know who've read anything, who read Labor's Giant Step or Cannon's history of the Trotskyist movement. Then we were active also, just prior to that, in the hotel strike of 1933. That was actually the period in which we began the turn toward mass work and into the trade union movement. By 1937, quite a large percentage of the party was in the unions, especially in the UAW and in Maritime. In 1937, in the Flint sit-in, which was the biggest and the best organized of all the sit-ins, it was organized by Trotskyists. Kermit Johnson was the main organizer of that, working with course, Janora Johnson, who organized the women, and others of our comrades. And Art Price was one of those who was brought in from Toledo as an advisor. The party had also penetrated rather deeply into maritime. We had a very special relationship with Harry Lundberg, who was busily engaged in fighting the Stalinists, who had made a turn toward the right at that time, and were trying to water down the militancy of the maritime unions on the West Coast. He needed a help in order to fight the Stalinists, and he was having a great deal of difficulty. He was came out of the syndicalist movement. And we were in contact with him, and he gave us actually an open door into the Sailors Union of the Pacific. It was at that time that Art Sharon, Frank Lovell, George Clark, Dave Bears, and others were sent into maritime, into the mostly into the SUP and some into the MCNS, the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union. Ruth, who's now in San Francisco, Ruth Haar, was in the office. She was second in command of the office of the Sailors Union Pacific by request of Harry Lundberg. Barney Mays, who was in the party at that time, was editor of the Voice of the Federation, which was the newspaper of the Maritime Federation on the West Coast. We were very active in the 1937 sailors' strike. In all of the unions that were, not only the unions that were on strike, but those that were in a supportive role. Tom Carey was editor of the Marine Fireman newspaper. Other newspapers also were headed up by some of our comrades. The party women primarily were working in the fish canneries, which was organized also by the SUP through the SIU, which was an affiliated organization. They led strikes and organized the fish cannery unions in collaboration with the union. At that time, we pulled comrades off the campuses, out of the offices, and whatever they were doing to take advantage of these great opportunities that were opening up for us to penetrate the trade union movement. I myself was recruited out of Imperial Valley. I don't know if you know what it is. It's down along the Mexican border. Out of a junior college down there, where I was led a anti-war strike in 1934. The party at that time was small, and it was very, very sensitive to any opportunity that arose where they thought they might recruit some of the militants in the student movement and in the trade union movement. For instance, they read about the strike in El Centro, the El Centro Junior College, in the San Diego Union, and they immediately sent Dick Fraser, who was later in Seattle, sent him down to Calexico to contact the leaders of the strike. And later on, they sent Charlie Curtis and others to contact us, and they recruited two people out of Imperial Valley, of which I was one. In 1937, we were still in the Socialist Party, which had the headquarters right across from the City Hall, big, big headquarters. I remember they wouldn't allow me to go there because they were afraid that they were having a big fight. It was just before they left the SP, and they were afraid that some of the SPers might get hold of me and influence me, so they told me stay away and just work in the union where you are. And after we come out of the SP, well, then we'll get together. By By 1938, there was quite a bit of penetration into the trade union movement. And in 1938, as you remember, the transitional program was adopted. And the transitional program, in a discussion around the transitional program, the party decided to take a very firm orientation toward the trade union movement to try to become a proletarian party. This was put number one on the agenda in 1938. Trotsky in particular, in the discussion, insisted on a turn toward the working class, toward the unions. And this is all documented in the documents of that time. The working class in that period, the period of the rise of the CIO, was very strongly in motion. Everywhere, things were happening. I remember one comrade was on the way back from a convention, and they came through, I think it was some small town in the Midwest somewhere, and they were stopping at a restaurant to have a midnight snack before they went on. And there were some workers there having something to eat, and they said they were talking about a sit-down strike that had taken place in some packing plant in that area, some little town in Indiana it was. And our comrades perked up their ears, and they decided to stay over another day. But that very evening, they got the location of the place. And they went out there, they drove out there, and they knocked on the door of the plant. There were workers that occupied the plant, and they were allowed to come in. They said that they were from California, and they'd had a little experience in strikes and organizing unions and so forth, and perhaps they could help. And the workers invited them in. They sat down, and they gave them talks on how they should go about the thing and so forth. And they stayed another day and helped them organize a union. There were many opportunities like this, and we tried to seize as many of them as we could. And in the process of doing this, the party became more and more working class. We began to recruit more workers in two ways. One, that our own comrades were sent into the trade union movement, and workers were recruited. And also, a little later on, in a negative way, in the split of 1940, it was a 40-60 split. The majority took 60%. But virtually all of the trade unionists stayed with the majority. And so we kept the working class cadres, and we lost the majority of the petty bourgeois element. The rise of the CIO, I'm not going to go into, because I'm certain that all of you have read Labor's Giant Step and Cannon's book on the history of American Trotskyism. And the period I'm supposed to cover tonight is the post-war period. But I'm going to make a few remarks about the war itself and the period just before the war. By 1939, the CIO was over the crest. A lot of the unions were organized. The major unions had been organized, with the exception of Steel and Ford, which was organized later. And it was becoming a bit housebroken. The CIO bureaucrats felt themselves secure in control of the unions, and they were beginning to buy for support of the attention of the capitalist state, vis-a-vis the AFL, the O-line bureaucrats. This was a period of the preparation for World War II, and both the AFL and the CIO bureaucrats supported preparations for World War II and went into the boards which were set up when the war started. Actually, at that time, the CIO, especially the CIO, led by the FDR's friend, Sidney Hillman, considered Franklin Delano Roosevelt the leader of the capitalist class, the president of the of the United States, also the leader of the trade union movement. But the role of the trade union movement and of the trade unions during World War II was quite different than during World War I. In 1914, prior to 1914, most of the strikes that had taken place had been broken very brutally by the use of company police, vigilantes, the National Guard, and in many cases the federal troops. The Ludlow Massacre of 1914, the Mooney Billing case 1916, the lumber strikes of the IWW in the Great Northwest in 1917, they were all broken. The only part of the trade union movement that remained organized was the craft unions, primarily the craft unions, which were tolerated by the capitalist class. There were some exceptions, the Great Lawrence strike of 1912, which was led by IWW, the McKees Rock strike of 1909. But most of the union strikes had been broken. And the workers, prior to World War I, were moving in a political direction toward the IWW and toward the Socialist Party, led by Eugene V. Debs. Just in passing, the FFL preamble, at that time and up until 1955, when the CIO and the FFL came back together, contained words about the struggle of the working class on an international scale, and that this is a struggle which must end with the working class getting its share of the world's goods and all that sort of thing. They had many fine words along those lines. This was a hangover from the early days of the AFL, when Samuel Gompers, for example, and you've heard of Samuel Gompers and Gomperism, was a socialist. And all the leaders, most of the leaders of the AFL in the early days, considered themselves radicals or socialists. Gompers, for example, studied German so that he could read Karl Marx in the original. But with the opening of World War I, the FFL leadership, with very few exceptions, capitulated to the war hysteria, just like they were social democrats or just straight bureaucrats, very much like the unions in Europe and the social democracy in Germany capitulated to the Kaiser. They called it a war against war, not a capitalist war, and a war that workers should support. And they played the game all the way. They agreed with Wilson not to conduct strikes, to help the government suppress strikes, and the greatest betrayal of all, they agreed not to organize unions during World War I. The Socialist Party, as you remember, split. The majority was opposed to the war, and the leader of that majority, Debs, went to jail, and the IWW also opposed the war, and they were virtually smashed in the process of World War I. Now, during World War II, it was quite different. World War II began right after the rise and the consolidation of the CIO, this great labor upsurge that built the CIO. Though the leaders of the AFL-CIO were willing to go all the way, and they might have liked to go Gompers one better, they couldn't deliver. Labor was in motion, and they just couldn't do it. And they had to wrest from the government certain concessions, which the government gladly gave them in order to get their acquiescence and their support of the war. And one of them was that the war industries would be organized into the existing unions, and organizing would go on during the war. They agreed to a no-strike pledge, but they weren't even able to deliver on that. Actually, during World War II, there were more strikes in that 3 years, than in the 3 years during the rise of the CIO. More strikes, more people on strike, and more strikes. There were 14,000 strikes during World War II, and a total of almost 7 million workers were on strike. And this is despite the opposition of the bureaucrats, and especially despite the opposition of the Stalinists, who supported the war all the way. I personally was involved in quite a number of not major strikes. I was in a Stalinist-led union, ILWU, and we didn't have any major strikes, but we had an awful lot of minor strikes over quite important questions. One of them was the question of gang size. Naturally, they tried to cut down the number of workers on certain types of operations. In the contract, it says you have to have a certain number of workers on a certain type of operation. And the union maintained that all during the war by a series of small work stoppages, by continual resistance. It also maintained the load limits, the amount of cargo that can be lifted in a certain load, the amount of work that could be given to men in a certain period of time. All these things were maintained during the war, with some exceptions. It was a continual fight back and forth, but pretty much they were maintained. Now, the unions were organized during the war, and the trade union movement came out of the war numerically much stronger than it had gone into the war, with a larger membership and with the traditions of the trade union movement pretty much intact. The party had a policy during World War II, which we called a policy of caution. We realized that there would be attempts to eliminate radicals from the trade union movement during the war, and we decided that we should cool it. We shouldn't take, at least until we were able to sense what the situation was, we shouldn't take any leadership roles, and we should sort of size up the situation and see what was going to happen. And that's the role we played. And it was very necessary because, especially the Communist Party during World War II, played a policeman role. And any time they would find anybody in the union was a Trotskyist or was playing any sort of a leadership role, they would hasten to try to eliminate them through collaboration with the trade union leadership or direct collaboration with the government agencies. We have many instances of this in our history. When the war broke out, I had come to San Francisco in 1937. The only kind of job I could get was in food, the food industry. We had quite a number of comrades in the food industry at that time, foods and hotels. And I was sent into the food industry. We built a sizable fraction in the food industry. In a couple of the unions, we were, at the time of the outbreak of the war, we were in a position of contending actually for leadership in the union. The time the war broke out, I was editor of a strike newspaper called The Hotel Worker. And it was decided by the party, Tom Carey was organizer in San Francisco, that this was not a very fruitful field and that I should get into a basic industry so that when the war was over that I'd be in a better position. And I was sent into Local 10, the Longshoremen's Union, in 1942. And I, as others, kept my mouth shut, especially till I got a book, because we knew that after the war we were going to have our chance. As a matter of fact, I expected after the war that there would be a revolution on the style of 1917 in Russia. During World War II, as I said, there were many strikes. The greatest of all, of course, were the three minor strikes that occurred in 1944, right in the middle of the war, where the miners shut the coal mines down. There was a Montgomery Ward strike, which was in 1944. That's the strike in which Bridges and the Communist Party played a special strike-breaking role. Then in 1944 began the fight against the no-strike pledge. And in 1944, the UAW convention voted 40% against the continuation of no-strike pledge and in favor of striking during wartime. That was 1944. We played a role in these things and began to recruit, starting in 1943, out of the mass movement. We instituted mass subscription drives. And I brought a copy of the Militant of 1944 to indicate what we did there. We began fund drives. In San Francisco, I remember in 1944, we had a mass subscription drive in which we got close to 1,000 subs. That was in the middle of the war. And this was taking place in other areas too. We found out what was possible during the war. And we had regular discussions and internal bulletins and party builders and so forth, relating what we were doing to what was possible after the war was over. And I want to read to you from the internal bulletin of October 1944, an article by Winters on what we found we could do during World War II and what would be possible after the war was over. The fundamental problem that has confronted us and will yet face us in the near future is how to function in the trade union movement without beheading ourselves, and conversely, how to function in the trade unions without stagnating this period of imperialist war and reaction. Nate goes on to say these are peacetide problems, but it becomes special problems during the World War II. The potential party recruit in the initial waking of class consciousness participates in his trade union. This is especially the case where the Negro worker is concerned. It is from this layer of workers, and you will find such groups everywhere, that our main source of recruits will come. It is necessary to know how to reach them and how to win them to a revolutionary party. And he goes on to say the kind of activities which we have been participating, like the fight against the no-strike pledge, the fight against the PAC and its role, and the fight against the government control through the War Labor Board, and finally the fight for the defense of the 18 through the CRDC. And the CRDC, the defense of the 18, was one of the most important activities that we carried on. We carried that on throughout the war and went to the unions, not only the unions we were in, but to all the trade union movement, and received a great deal of support, thousands and thousands of union members through their unions supported the fight of the 18. The 1944 Michigan CIO convention, for example, voted support. And many CIO and even some of the FFL unions, national unions, voted support for the 18 and their civil rights in Minneapolis. In San Francisco, for example, through the work of defense of the 18, we recruited a prominent ACLU leader, a lawyer, George Olshausen, who later became famous as a defender of Tokyo Rose. No, it was a very important thing. Tokyo Rose defense was happened to be caught. She was visiting, and she was a Japanese girl from Imperial Valley, as a matter of fact. And when the war broke out, she was in Japan. So they impressed her into the radio service, and she read She read the announcement. She spoke English very well, of course. She'd come out of American schools, and she read all these bulletins which were beamed to the American troops. And after the war, she was an American citizen. She returned to the United States. And so they put her on trial for treason. And he defended her, and he got her off. She never went to jail. Now, we found that we could operate during World War II. We had a policy of caution, but as the movement began to develop, as the opposition to the war began to develop, we pitched in everywhere we could, and we began to recruit. We began to sell subscriptions to the militant. We raised money for the party. We were able to do a great deal in defense of the 18. Now, we expected at the end of the war there would be a tremendous explosion. The labor movement would begin to move. It would become radicalized, and it would move in the direction of a revolution. And things did explode. Despite the efforts of the trade union leaders and especially of the Communist Party, with the close of the war, strikes began, and very important big strikes. The Communist Party played a very special role in that period because they had a position that after the war, the agreements which had been reached between the Stalinists, the Soviet Union, and the Allies would continue. There would be a peaceful period in which they would continue to collaborate, and the workers would be able to get their just desserts, and everything was going to be fine, just as rosy as could be. They projected a 5-year peace plan after the war. But that isn't the way it worked out. When the war was over, the layoffs began, the war industries began to close up, and unemployment grew by leaps and bounds. And the American capitalist class moved very quickly against the trade union movement. They tried everything they'd tried before. They tried to use the veterans, they tried to use the divide the blacks against the whites, and all that sort of thing. But none of it worked. And primarily because the trade union movement was intact, it had developed its resources and developed leadership in the middle of World War II, and it was ready for a fight. And everything that was tried was failed, and the trade union movement moved forward. The first major strike in the Bay Area was a machinist strike right at the end of the war in 1945. And here is where the first real break came for us as far as the Communist Party was concerned. Shortly before that, the Duclos letter. I don't know if you remember what the Duclos letter was. It was a letter that came out of France denouncing Browder for his collaboration with the capitalist class during World War II, and especially for the giving up of the Communist International. And when the Duclos letter came out, it caused a split in the Communist Party of the United States. And this split was especially deep in the Bay Area. And the split showed itself first in the trade union field of the machinist strike of 1945. And we were able to work very closely with the members of the Communist Party who had split off on basis of the Duclos letter, and felt that the Communist Party had become a collaborationist, outfit, and was no longer fit to lead the working class. And they collaborated with us. And out of that split, we recruited quite a number of people and others that we found that we could work with. We recruited at that time people like Ed Lee. I don't know if you know, he's still around here somewhere in this side of the bay. Jimmy Kiernan, Harry Press, and others who became leading members of the party. The 1946 branch report turned entirely on what we were on our major area of work, which was the trade union movement, plus the the fight to defend the 18, and the beginnings of our work in the black movement. That time, of course, it was called the Negro movement. The statistics on recruitment in that period are very interesting. In the period of 1944, we recruited 308 members to the party. This was the beginning of the recruitment, which continued in 1945 and 1946. The average age was 27 and a half years. White recruits were 87.3. Black recruits, 12%, which is higher than the population ratio. And we also had some Filipino recruits and Chinese recruits. Male recruits were 66 and two-thirds percent. Female recruits, 33%. Trade union recruits were out of the unions. Workers were 76% during the period of 1944. That's a period of 9 months. I'm sorry, not 12 months. A period of 9 months. And this was directly a result of our trade union work. That was a period of not only maritime activity and strikes in the machinists, but it was a period of the Oakland General Strike, which some of our comrades here, I guess the only comrade remaining here who participated in that strike is Paul Montauk. And I wasn't involved in that strike, and maybe after my report, he can give you a short rundown on that particular strike. That was the first general strike in the Bay Area since the 1934 general strike in San Francisco. We were also active in the anti-fascist campaign, the fight against Gerald L. K. Smith. There was a developing fascist movement after World War II. It was a very natural development as far as the capitalist class was concerned to move against the working class and the unions with the fascist fist. And Gerald L. K. Smith was the major leader of that movement. I remember he came here in 1945, the end of 45 or the beginning of 1946, as a result of a motion which was made by one of our comrades in the ILWU, which went to the CIO Labor Council and went to the AFL unions too. The trade union movement in the Bay Area organized a mass protest against a meeting of Gerald L. K. Smith, which was held at Norris Auditorium in San Francisco. And they got out 10,000 pickets with all their signs and sound trucks and all the paraphernalia which the trade union movement, when it goes into action, can muster. And there was no meeting. The pickets locked arms and were able to prevent, by peaceful methods mostly, the meeting from taking place. I think maybe a total of 15 or 20 people actually got through the picket lines. At that time, we also moved directly into the area of defense of the civil rights of the black people in California. That was the period of the Fontana case, where a family which was living in had moved into a white area near Los Angeles, near the Fontana steel mills, was burned out, and I think four of the family were killed in the fire. We moved into that case very quickly, sent speakers up and down California, and made a big impact. I remember as a result of the Fontana case, in San Francisco, one evening, we recruited 12 black comrades to the party. Most of them were out of the shipyards of Hunters Point. One of them was named Henry Ford. Well, I remember him particularly because Henry Ford was a shipyard worker, a very bright fellow. He came out of the South during the war and went to work in the shipyards, and he became a very highly skilled welder. But he couldn't read and write. He never had the opportunity to learn to read and write. And when he came into the party, one of the first things we did was assign a comrade as his teacher to teach him to read and write. And he made progress very, 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 very fast. Uh, 1946 has been called by the period of labor's greatest upsurge. And it was a tremendous period. Everywhere you turned, there was a strike. Everybody was on strike, trying to make up for what had been lost during World War II. Because the strikes during World War II were mainly defensive strikes. They weren't the kind of strikes which could make great gains. They were strikes against what the capitalist class was trying to take away. And the Socialist Workers' Party attained its greatest size and influence. I think perhaps the party has now reached that point. I'm not sure. I think probably it has. But that was a period where we were the largest and had the greatest influence. The Trotskyists in the trade union movement were recognized leaders, militants in many cases. They were secondary leaders and even officials of the unions, especially in the CIO. There were quite a number of national fractions organized. UAW had a national fraction. The Maritime had a national fraction. And these national fractions were a little bit different than the fractions like you have in the, though we have national fractions also in the anti-war movement today. But the Maritime fraction, to give an example, and we will see this type of development again, the Maritime fraction was organized nationally. A merchant seaman was a member of the national fraction. Wherever he went to a branch, he would participate in that branch work. The decisions were made nationally and by the fractions, and the decisions of the national fraction and the local fraction superseded, in most cases, were not influenced by the decisions of the branch. Because the work was national work, and it was not possible for the branches individually to make decisions on basis of what the national fraction would do. Because it was coastwise work, it was work all over the world. The auto fraction also had a national fraction in which the decisions were made nationally. And there were regular reports back and forth between all these fractions, interchange of minutes, and so on and so forth. I was part of the Maritime fraction as a longshoreman. And internal discussion was carried on in the fraction preparatory to decisions being made. Was directly under the national fractions worked directly under the national committee. All the other fractions in the trade union movement, except a few national fractions, were directly organized under the direction of the local executive boards and the party branch itself. And we had fractions in virtually all the uptown unions, food, clerical workers. We had the fractions in the warehouse unions. And in the office workers, we had people too. Now, perhaps later in the discussion, we can talk a little bit more about how fractions were organized, but I'll skip that right now. The party played not only a role in far as developing the various positions of the party and recruiting to the party and selling militants and spreading the revolutionary ideas of the party, but in the 1946 strike, it also played a very special role in keeping the trade union movement, especially where we were active, on a correct course. The Stalinists, especially with their line of post-war peace, their line of watering down the struggle, attempted at every opportunity to disrupt the struggle and to, if they could, sell it out. And in the trade union movement in San Francisco, in the SUP strike of 1946, they organized a group of 11 unions, which included the Marine Cooks and Stewards, the Longshoremen, the Warehousemen, one of the Machinist Unions, and several other unions which were around the waterfront, and actually issued an ultimatum to the Sailors Union Pacific, which was on strike, that unless the SUP agreed to certain conditions, that certain ships would be allowed to sail, that the unions other than the Sailors Union Pacific would be allowed to give clearances for work and clearances for the movement of cargo, that they would not support the strike. And they brought this program into the unions, into my union, for example, into local 10. And they tried to put it over. We fought this very vigorously wherever we were. And we just took the position, this is not good trade unionism, and you say this is your position, and the SUP is doing all these terrible things, and they're trying to get ahead of the rest of the labor movement, and they're disrupting the unity of the labor movement. But let's invite them in. Let's listen to them. Let's hear what they have to say. Let's contact their strike committee and ask for speakers. And we were able to put over this kind of a very sensible motion, and we invited to our meetings, wherever we had people, we invited representatives of the Sailors Union Pacific Strike Committee to come. And I remember in my union, the speaker that was sent was a member of our party. His name was Frank Barbaria, who at one time was candidate for mayor, several times was candidate for mayor of San Francisco. And he came to our union, a union meeting of 10,000, and spoke to the meeting, and was able to sway that meeting against Bridges, against Henry Schmidt, against all the speakers that could be put up against him. Of course, he had some support from the floor in order to support the SUP strike all the way and to leave the reign of the strike to the SUP. As was pointed out in the discussion in San Francisco by Bob Chester, when it came a question of selecting a speaker to go to Local 10, where they knew they were going to be up against all the high-powered CPers like Harry Bridges, our comrades suggested that other people go, you know, and no one would go except one of our own comrades. And he took this very unpleasant assignment and he carried it off very beautifully. In the UAW, in Los Angeles, we had a very solid fraction. Our comrades were some among the leadership of the local, and one of our comrades was on the National Strike Committee in the strikes which took place in 1946, 47, and 48. In 1946, in my union, we had three comrades who were on the Coastwise Strike Committee, the central committee of the whole West Coast, which controlled the strike up and down the West Coast. And I was one of those individuals. I was elected from Local 10 to the Central Strike Committee for the West Coast. These were periods of tremendous big meetings, and all these strikes, there was rank-and-file participation, very broad rank-and-file participation, and when all the unions were on strike, would get together like in the CMU, we would have meetings of 12 to 15,000 at the Civic Auditorium in San Francisco. In the big strike of 1948, we had people on the Central Strike Committee, and this was the strike in which probably we played the biggest role. The Stalinists had taken quite a turn to the right again. This was in 1947, was the Taft-Hartley bill was passed. The repression was beginning to set in the whole period of McCarthy, the whole McCarthy period. And there was a general movement to the right and part of the leadership of the trade union movement. In the middle of this came the 1948 strike, the biggest strike that and the longest strike, 99 days, that the longshoremen ever conducted. And we had several people on the Central Strike Committee for the West Coast, including myself. I remember Frank Lovell was all the merchant seamen, and we had a large fraction, were, of course, on the beach because they couldn't sail while the longshoremen were on strike. And so we had all these comrades from the maritime fraction, the Sailors Union Pacific, the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, the Marine Firemen's Union, at more or less at the disposal of our comrades who were on strike in longshore. And it was very, very useful. Frank Lovell was assigned by the maritime fraction, by the party, to be the advisor of the ILWU fraction. And I remember we used to meet every morning. We had a strike committee meeting every day except Sunday. And because after this was the committee that controlled the whole West Coast strike, and there were, I guess there were maybe 25,000 longshoremen on strike. And we met every morning for breakfast down the waterfront, and we would discuss the affairs of the day before and what probably would happen on that day. And I was absolutely amazed that Frank Lovell was able to predict so well what would happen. He really understood the bureaucratic mind. And he would say quite often, well, this is what they're going to do today. And 9 times out of 10, that's exactly the way it would happen. And of course, we carried on a coastwise collaboration with Pedro, where we had somebody on the strike committee, and with Seattle, where we had somebody on the strike committee. The issue, the way we formulated it, was a tight strike. Now, the Stalinists, reflecting their general political analysis of things, their general political position, had a position that there were good and bad employers. And the thing you wanted to do was collaborate with the good employers and really get hard with the bad employers. And we took a position in the strike, especially in the strike where you're tying up transportation, that there's no such thing as good and bad employers unless they sign a contract and pay the union wages. Because they were willing to go on basis of promises. If someone promised, well, we'll pay anything which will come out of your strike, well, that will be fine. And they would let them move cargo. And we took a position against this. And we had some very interesting discussions and some very interesting fights. And actually, by the time the strike was over, we, in collaboration with the right wing of the union, because the right wing actually wanted to preserve the union, wanted to win the strike, we were able to win a majority of the strike committee on the whole West Coast for our positions. And there were a lot of interesting things that happened. One of the other issues, and flows from the same thing, was the issue of foreign ships. The Stalinists had a position that foreign ships, should be allowed to move during the strike. After all, we were not on strike against the foreign ships. The foreign ships were, they were under other unions, Swedish unions, German unions, Italian unions, or in some cases no unions at all, but we weren't on strike against them. Our position was that nothing should move. If the foreign ships could move the cargo, then the strike would go on and perhaps and it could lead to losing the strike. Here's where our comrades in the SUP came in very, very handy. We dispatched a group of young SUP comrades headed up by a comrade from the MFOW, Marshall Uran, to the library, and they did a tremendous research job. And they found out that most of the foreign shipping companies were directly involved with American capital, and quite often they were subsidiaries or owned in a large part by the American shipping companies. So they printed up a document This is it. They printed up a document. They did this in 48 hours. They printed up a document which I took into the strike committee, the beginning strike committee, and distributed to every member of the strike committee, 125 people on the strike committee. And then we debated the issue, and they didn't have a leg to stand on, because we showed them that the foreign shipping lines were directly involved in American capital, and it's absolutely ridiculous to let them sail because you were just helping your enemies. Now, throughout all of our trade union work, we applied the central ideas of our transitional program, which was worked out in 1938, which was, and I gave you some examples, no confidence in the government, workers' defense guards, which we advocated in all of the strikes, and we pushed this question, democratic decision making. We insisted in the 1948 strike, 1946 strike, and all the other strikes, that the negotiating meetings be open, that any member of the union be allowed to walk into any negotiating meeting. There be no secret negotiations. And we were able, especially in ILWU, to push this through. And it was really something to see these bureaucrats sitting there with employers and a bunch of guys, rough workers, walk in to this meeting and sit down and take notes, and then so that when the next meeting they could get up there and say, well, wait a minute now, this is what you said. I heard what you said, the boss. Yeah, but you watch it there now. You're not doing what we told you to do, and all that sort of thing. It was a very beautiful scene. Sliding scale of wages and hours. Open the books. Open the closed factories. Workers' control. Labor Party. These were the instruments that we used, and always applied it very concretely with a very careful attention to facts. I realize this is rather sketchy, and it must necessarily be because it's quite a lengthy period to be covered in such a short time. But it was a very important period in the party's life, because out of this strike wave, out of what we did in this whole period, the building of the cadres and the development of the cadres, the experience that we got in the trade union work and in the other work we carried on, the anti-fascist work, the work we did in our black work and all that sort of thing, we built a cadre which was able to carry through the McCarthy period and be there when the new upsurge began in 1964-65. Now, the party was different then. It was largely a workers' party. It was largely a proletarian party. It was a continuation of the strike period of 1934-1941. The upsurge would have been muted during World War II, but was not stopped and continued after World War II. The motion against the status quo at that time was in the unions, and that's where we were. There was not a great deal of motion except in a supportive role among the students, among the intellectuals, and so forth, though there was some. And we didn't have a youth movement during World War II or after World War II. We had one during the period of the 30s. The source of our cadre during that period was quite different. Now, beginning in 1959, with the Cuban Revolution, or even a little earlier, 1956, with recruitment, with the Khrushchev revelations, we began to recruit again. But the recruitment now was different. We began to recruit somewhat from the Communist Party, the breakup of the Communist Party, but mostly from the developing student radicalization through these issues of Cuban Revolution, and then the rise of the anti-war movement, which began in 1964. But the basic orientation of our party, as I understand it, has not changed. We know that the student movement and the anti-war movement in itself, such as it is, cannot change society. We know that only working class can do that. And this is still our direction. And at the first chance, we will turn again toward the trade union movement when there is motion there, without giving up the basis that we have that we've established during the period that I'm talking about. There has been some discussion, and the discussion probably will continue, on the difference in the workers' movement today. It is different. It is different. In the period in which I'm talking, the social workers, the nurses, the teachers, the professionals, white-collar workers, were not conscious of themselves as workers, as they are now. This is where there's a great deal of motion at the present time. And in a sense, in a certain sense, there is a bit of a repetition of the type of recruitment which took place in the period of 1929-1935, where we recruited intellectuals and students primarily, in a different historical context, of course, and then used those cadres when the trade union movement began to move, when the workers' movement began to move, used those cadres to send into the unions and to build a party. I say there's a different historical context, and it is quite different. In those days, the level of consciousness was primarily on an economic level. The building of the trade union movement, the fighting for wages and conditions. There's a deepening of political consciousness now, especially in the international sense, a feeling that the whole struggle is an international struggle. The feeling about Vietnam, the feeling about Cuba. All these things are somewhat different. There was no deep feeling in the trade union among the workers, say in the period of 1937, about the Spanish Civil War. And because of this difference in the consciousness, the recruits that will come out of the workers' struggles in the coming period will be, in my opinion, on a much higher political level, who will come to us not so much as they did during the period of which I'm talking on basis of our activities in the unions. They came to us because we were the best fighters in the unions. And they said, well, you're a socialist too, but you're a hell of a trade unionist, and I want to belong to the organization you belong to. And then when they came into the party, that's when you began to educate them about socialism. But now there's more recruiting people directly on the basis of socialism, even out of the trade unions. And I think that is the direction that we will move in. Now, these are differences, and we don't have time to discuss them now. I just got a note here that I should pause in 2 minutes. So I will end up by saying that my feeling is that it isn't very long in the future that we will find that our party will again have the opportunity to intervene very vigorously and very productively in the way in which we recruited in the past. And given the historical context, I think that it will be even more fruitful, that we will be able to build the kind of a mass party with its roots, into every area of the American working class, which will be able to...